Yes.
Thank you, Madeline and Judy, and I appreciate the opportunity as somebody who has a point of view which is not only out of the mainstream, but also out of the conservative mainstream. And I think that certain issues need to be discussed, and this kind of forum is very good for it. We have no need to discuss the Islam problem at length. Since the 9/11 attack, we all know, everybody here knows what it is. At the most obvious level, of course, it is terrorism. But then we began to realize that calling the enemy terror, as in war on terror, was mistaken. Since terrorism is just a means, a weapon, and you don't have a war against a weapon. The real problem, we all began to realize, is jihad. The eternal command on Muslims, in the words of the Quran, fight against those among the people of the book who do not believe in Allah and the last day, who do not forbid what Allah and His Messenger have forbidden, and who do not consider the true religion as their religion, until they pay the jizya tax with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. This command will continue until the last day, when, as stated in numerous passages in the Quran, and especially in the Hadiths, the last hour will not come before the Muslims fight the Jews and the Muslims kill them, so that the Jews will hide behind stones and trees, and the stone in the tree will say, O Muslim, O servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. 1300 years before Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, Muhammad declared that the perfection of the world would not be reached until that day when all Jews were exterminated, when even the forces of nature, even the stones and the trees, would work together to rid the universe of accursed Jews. Hitler never had anything to compare with this. And yet, Hitler burned himself out in 12 years, and Islam is still going strong. And this is why I have called Muhammad the successful Hitler, because he built a sustainable movement that manages to function through every kind of contingency, while Hitler didn't know how to manage things and burnt himself out, thankfully. So we realized that the real problem wasn't terror. The real problem was jihad. But then we Islam critics went to the next stage of understanding the problem. We began to realize that jihad is only a means to an objective and not the real end. But what is the objective itself? It is the rule of Sharia, the imposition of Islamic law over each society and ultimately over all of humanity. Sharia is the true enemy of Sharia is the true end of Islam. Sharia is practically identical with Islam, because wherever Muslims are in power and are able to act fully as Muslims, Sharia is the all-ruling power of society governing every aspect of life. Sharia includes the institutionalized inferiority of women, as we all know, the institutionalized inferiority of non-Muslims, the death sentence for anyone who converts out of Islam, and the prohibition, the death sentence, on criticizing Islam. And we've already seen this not only in Muslim countries that we were, but even countries that we are now in charge of and occupying and supporting their government, like Afghanistan. We freed Afghanistan in the name of freedom, and now we are sustaining a Sharia government, which executes apostates, imprisons, and executes people who criticize Islam. But now we come to the issue that I want to address today. Lots of people know these things about Islam that I've just mentioned. Lots of people know the truth about Islam. There is an entire school, an entire movement of Islam critics, eloquent and passionate writers and speakers who have made a tremendous contribution to awakening at least the conservative readership to the nature of the threat we face. In article after article, in speech after speech, they lay out, and they pointed out that Islam is a mortal threat to our society and our freedom and our entire way of being and our way of life. But there is a problem with this picture. As you read their books and articles, you realize that despite their constant warnings about how terrible and dangerous Islam is to us, they never say what we should do about this great threat, what we should do that will actually save us from it. And most remarkably, the Islam critics never talk about how Islam got into the West in the first place, which was through the immigration of Muslims. They never talk about how to stop more Muslims and more Islam and more Sharia from coming into the West, which is by stopping and greatly reducing Muslim or greatly reducing Muslim immigration. Again, the critics have made a great contribution in teaching the public about the nature and doctrines of Islam. But what is going on here? And this is something I've written about a lot. Never talk about how it came into being and how to stop its growth. Think about any kind of problem that society deals with. If there's harmful discrimination, well, we outlaw it or discourage it. If there is excessive air pollution, we do things to reduce air pollution. If there is a foreign enemy, we fight or deter him. With every kind of problem and danger that faces society, there is people diagnose the problem, and then they propose a solution to it, except when it comes to Islam. Why is this? Why is there this weird and unnatural silence on what to do about the Islam problem? Some people say that the Islam critics are afraid of political correctness, afraid for their jobs, afraid for their lives. But I don't believe that. With all the hot issues that these people, these conservative writers deal with, that make, there's all kinds of contentious issues going on in society. Simply to say that it would be a good idea to reduce Muslim immigration would not be such a big deal. So in my view, it's not because the Islam critics are afraid of what would happen to them personally if they offered a solution, such as stopping or reducing Muslim immigration. It's because they themselves do not believe in that solution. And why don't they? And here we come to one of the most important facts about modern society. The guiding principle of modern liberalism is that discrimination is the most terrible evil and must be eliminated and avoided at all costs. It's the belief that anyone who discriminates is morally wicked. Non-discrimination is the highest moral principle of our society. It is the principle to which all other principles must ultimately yield. And yet, it's never discussed, it's never criticized. Why? Because it is the highest principle, and you cannot criticize it. Whatever is highest in a society is sacred and cannot be touched. Where did this idea come from? There are different ways of approaching it. I think the two main factors were Nazism and the Civil Rights Movement. At the end of World War II, when the reality of the Nazi Holocaust came before the world, people began to say that, and in particular, the father of Anne Frank, Otto Frank, said this, that this was an act of intolerance. He described the systematic, demonic destruction of an entire people as an act of intolerance. Well, what did that mean? That would mean that intolerance must be eliminated. The greatest evil must be eliminated. He took a garden variety human phenomenon, which is intolerance. There's all kinds of intolerance. You can't eliminate intolerance. He took this garden variety human phenomenon that every society has in different ways and said, this is the ultimate evil. This is what must be eliminated. And the guiding rule of modern liberalism, wherever there is discrimination, intolerance, it cannot be accepted, it must be eliminated. And this has become the project of modern society. Every area, when you're talking about race, about immigration, about women and men, about sexual orientation, the guiding principle is always, there's discrimination, it must be eliminated. So, and I think a lot of that came out of the heightened concern about discrimination with relation to the Nazis, and then misapplying that concern to every issue in society, so that in effect, everything in life that could be called discriminatory became the moral equivalent of Nazism. Now, you see this all the time. Every Hollywood movie. Anything that's discriminatory is seen as evil. And another dimension of it was, of course, the Civil Rights Movement. White America acknowledged at the time of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 that there was discrimination against blacks, which was not morally acceptable to us. And as a result of that, and that was correct, but they again went too far and said, well, every kind of discrimination is wrong. And that became, that principle was then applied to everyone. So here's an example of how powerful the principle of non-discrimination is. After 9/11, when we had seen Muslims all over the world cheering the attack on America, many people would have expected that America would become more critical and suspicious of Islam. But the exact opposite happened. President Bush began to call Islam a religion of peace. Radical Muslim clerics and activists were invited and welcomed into the highest councils of our national life and our government. PBS ran an endless series of documentaries about Islam that were on the level of travelogues, treating Islam as the most wonderful, positive, enriching thing in the world. The lesson here is that the rule of non-discrimination requires that the more dangerous or problematic or hostile a minority or non-Western group becomes, the more we must praise it. It's the exact opposite of normal logic. In normal logic, the more problematic a group or a person is, the more critical of it or him we naturally become. But under modern liberalism, with its principle of non-discrimination, the more problematic a group is, the more we must tell lies to ourselves about it in order to make it look better than it really is, so as to avoid discriminating against it. So this rule of non-discrimination turns normal logic, normal moral thinking on its head. Just as in the economic realm, socialism turns normal logic on its head and says, whoever produces more should be, you know, punished more, whoever is not producing, you know, so on. Now, what I've just said is not entirely true of the Islam critics. They do say negative things about Islam, but they always deflect the problem from Islam itself into some side issue. President Bush said the problem was terrorists, enemies of peace, dead-enders. He never said the problem was Islamic terrorists or Islam. Mainstream conservatives say that the problem is Islamofascism. Completely fictitious concept. There's no such thing as Islamofascism. They never say the problem is Islam. Daniel Pipes says that the problem is modern, radical, politicized Islam, and that the solution is the supposedly moderate traditional Islam. No one wants to state the simple truth that Islam itself is the problem. Because if they said it, that would mean we must do certain things about it, such as excluding it, which means discriminating against it, which is, according to our beliefs, the most evil thing that a person can do, the equivalent of being a Nazi. And by the way, I think I said this the night of the Europe Builders event here 2 months ago, about 3 years ago, I was at a small meeting in which there were some interesting people discussing the Islam problem. And the editor of a prominent conservative magazine, the Islam problem was being discussed in very frank terms. And then I said, well, what about, you know, stopping Muslim immigration and maybe reversing Muslim immigration to some extent? And this editor said, if we stopped Muslim immigration, we would be as immoral as the terrorists. This was a conservative editor of a conservative magazine. So this is an illustration of what I'm saying, that even the most necessary discrimination to prevent enemies of our country from coming in, if we do that, we are seen as being as evil as the most evil people in the world, the terrorists. That's the liberal mentality, which is not just among liberals. It's also shared by many people who are in the conservative camp and call themselves conservatives. This is why I say that the liberal ideology
modern liberalism, post-World War II liberalism, controls both liberals and conservatives.
As long as this paralysis remains in place, Islam and Sharia will continue to grow in our midst. More numbers, more power, more accommodation, more Muslims welcome to the White House, more acceptance of Sharia courts, Sharia foot washing in universities and places of work, special facilities produced for Muslims, Sharia food, which is first demanded just for Muslims, and then it becomes easier, well, just make Sharia food for everybody. Sharia marriage laws, Sharia prohibition on criticism of Islam. We will find ourselves living in an unfree, Islamicized country, something that would have been inconceivable 70 years ago, before modern liberalism came into being. So what does Ms. Zaidi Subna propose that we do? Does she support our present immigration policies, leading to continually increasing number of Muslims and Sharia supporters in America and the West? If she does, then she supports the ever-increasing power and influence of Sharia in the West. And this is, I think, will be the issue between us. What should we do? The things I'm about to suggest may seem impossible and so out of step with contemporary liberal ways of thinking that it may seem insane. My answer is that contemporary liberal ways of thinking are themselves insane and are leading the West to destruction at the hands of Islam. Therefore, something radically different is needed. We must think anew and we must act anew. My approach consists of a series of steps, starting with the most obvious and necessary and justifiable, with the option of moving on to more serious steps if the earlier steps do not have the desired effect. At a very minimum, Muslim immigration must be significantly reduced or stopped altogether. In the last year, Robert Spencer has called for the end of all Muslim immigration. Other Islam critics have not followed his lead, unfortunately. Muslim illegal aliens must be removed. And this is something that can be readily accomplished back in the early part of the decade. The federal government required or called for Pakistanis, I don't know why they singled out Pakistanis at the time, to report themselves to the government and make their presence known. And as a result, there was an instantaneous exodus of an uncertain number, but it was in the thousands, of Pakistani men leaving the United States. Many of them went back to Pakistan, others went to Canada, which was more welcome. This gives an example of people come into a country when that country sends out signs that they are welcome, that they are accepted. Once the society starts to say, you know, we're not so sure about this, that affects the behavior of prospective immigrants and the prospective illegal aliens. We have great, anybody that says there's nothing we can do about this problem is somebody who doesn't want to do. Now, when it comes to legal immigrants, we need to expel the most objectionable and the most excludable of them. Non-citizen legal resident aliens who vocally espouse jihad and Sharia activities should lose their residency and be deported. Remember, legal residents do not have any right to be here. A citizen, of course, does. A legal resident is here as a privilege, not as a right. No resident alien who adheres to the doctrines of jihad or Sharia should be naturalized as a U.S. citizen. To be naturalized, immigrants should be required to state under oath that they totally reject and have no association with jihad and Sharia. If they are found later to be in violation of their oath, their naturalization shall be revoked. All mosques, Islamic centers, and schools that promote jihad and Sharia in any form should be closed. Instead of complaining about this all the time, let's do something about it. The United States, all right, let's skip that. Now finally, we have to acknowledge that some of the measures I've mentioned here, and there are others, but this is a basis on which, you know, I'd say a minimal basis of a serious policy. But we have to acknowledge that some of the measures I've mentioned here would be seen as a violation of the First Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, which says Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. There is only one sure way around that obstacle. A federal statute, or better,
a constitutional amendment which states that Islam is not a religion under the meaning of the First Amendment, but that it is a political ideology aimed at achieving tyrannical political power over non-Muslims. Once such a law or amendment is passed, then it will become possible to pass and maintain against various challenges the other needed measures. The minimal and perhaps the sufficient goal of the policy is to make Sharia-believing Muslims feel unwelcome here, leading many of them to depart voluntarily. The goal is not zero Muslims in America. The goal is to reverse our present course so that the number and power of the Sharia believers, rather than steadily increasing as it is at present, will be steadily decreasing. So the Islam threat will be becoming steadily less rather than steadily more. The ultimate goal is a much smaller Muslim population in the U.S., consisting of people who do not believe in Sharia or jihad, who don't believe in political Islam, but see Islam as a purely private faith. Now, when Sufna has her chance to speak, if she feels that what I've proposed here is off the charts, what does she propose doing to stop and propose the growth of Sharia in America? Thank you very much.